Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. Tranexamic acid, or TXA, has been used for a wide variety of indications since its development in 1962 and subsequent FDA approval in 1986. Over the last decade, new data has surfaced illustrating the potential benefits and harms of TXA in a wide variety of different bleeding indications. The mixed data has led to confusion on when TXA is appropriate. Today, we listen in on Dr. Nicholas Vollmer, a critical care pharmacist at Mayo Clinic, as he reviews the TXA files to discuss the evidence behind major treatment indications using tranexamic acid.
In 1962, two Japanese researchers developed a compound that became formally known as tranexamic acid, or TXA for short. Little did they know when they developed the compound in 1962, it was actually first marketed as an oral agent for mild to moderate bleeding associated with things like tooth extractions and heavy periods. It took about 50 years, and its use exploded in the last 10 years, looking at a variety of new and different indications for bleeding management. So when I was coming up with this presentation, I was curious to why did its use explode so much in the last 10 years, and why did it take 50 years for that to happen? And I think a couple of the reasons include it's cost-effective, it's got a favorable safety profile, and it's a good intervention for a lot of different bleeding management disorders. It's even got itself a spot on the World Health Organization's list of essential and safe medications that each health facility should utilize. Today we're going to be discussing a little bit about baseline knowledge surrounding tranexamic acid, or TXA, to build a foundational basis to continue to discuss it. Then we're going to go into some different primary literatures around different indications that support or refute its benefits. And then lastly, we're going to identify some pharmacotherapy pearls related to its use, specifically safety and adverse effects, as well as how should we dose it in patients and how do we use it in these alternative indications as well. So to start, I think it's important to discuss the standard clotting mechanism to identify where tranexamic acid is actually working in our patients. I want to draw everyone's attention to the right image here, specifically the right half of the right image, where plasminogen turns into its active form plasmin, which acts on fibrin. And fibrin is the ultimate product of the normal coagulation cascade. Now, fibrin is that mesh network that holds together a clot. And so plasmin works on fibrin by destabilizing the clot, allowing bleeding to resume. So where does tranexamic acid fit into this picture? Well, it actually targets plasminogen, doing two things. It inhibits some of the conversion to its active form plasmin, as well as it deactivates plasmin's ability to degrade fibrin into those fibrin split products, keeping the clot together longer, which is also represented by the left image here by it's essentially a wedge within that on the competitive inhibitor of the lysine receptor. So this leads me to my first question, and I encourage everyone in the audience, as well as if you're watching from your computer screen or at home, to respond at polleverywhere.com at mayo.rx. Or you can text MayoRx to 22333 to join. Which of the following regarding the mechanism of action of TXA is true? It binds directly to fibrinogen, preventing its conversion to fibrin, thus stabilizing the clot. It is an analog of thrombin, causing increased conversion of fibrinogen to fibrin, thus stabilizing the clot. It binds to plasminogen, preventing its active form plasmin from destabilizing the clot. And then lastly, it binds to plasmin directly, preventing the degradation of the fibrin clot. I'll give us a couple seconds here to answer. I would agree with the majority of responses here with C. So it binds directly to plasminogen, preventing its active form plasmin from destabilizing the clot, keeping the clot there longer, preventing further hemorrhage or bleeding. It's not A, B, or D, as I mentioned in the last slide, just based purely off of its mechanism of action. So throughout today's presentation, I wanted to talk about some of the major trials and literature supporting the various indications that TXA has been evaluated in. Everything from perioperative bleeding to postpartum hemorrhage to trauma, ICH, epistaxis, hemoptysis, and gastrointestinal bleeding. We're going to go through each of these indications, discussing some of the major trials and the concerns related to trials, as well as the pros and things you should be taking away from it. So to start, let's jump into perioperative bleeding. Now, perioperative bleeding, and this is not an all-inclusive list, and I know there's quite a bit on here, but I wanted to highlight the fact that there's so many trials out there evaluating perioperative bleeding. Everything from cardiac surgery to CABG to spine surgeries to THAs to just oral surgeries as well, or just systematic reviews of perioperative bleeding in general. And something you'll notice in terms of trends in the major outcomes is that TXA has consistently shown to reduce the rate of blood transfusions. And not only that, when used, it reduces the amount of volume needed in that blood transfusion. Not only that, it's got very minimal safety or adverse effects associated with it, with the only study really identifying a concern as the Atticus study by Miles in 2017, which notified a seizure risk associated with TXA. And we'll circle back at the end of the presentation to discuss a little bit more about this potential seizure risk. So in summary, it reduces blood loss and blood product use with no increase in thromboembolism, potentially an increased risk of seizures, but we'll circle back and discuss why that might have been found. And not only that, there's a lot of ongoing research evaluating its use in various perioperative settings, and there's a lot going on right now contributing to this research robust pool. So in general, I will give perioperative bleeding a green check mark and a go-ahead for tranexamic acid. But what about postpartum hemorrhage, or PPH for short? PPH, there's two major trials that TXA was evaluated in, and that's the WOMAN trial and the TRAP trial. Now, a major difference between these two trials was the WOMAN trial evaluated TXA's use in treatment of PPH, whereas the TRAP trial evaluated TXA's use in prevention of PPH. Now, the WOMAN trial was a massive study in 193 hospitals in 21 countries with a sample size just over 20,000 patients. Patients were randomized to either IV TXA at 1 gram versus a placebo, and their primary outcome they evaluated was all-cause mortality or hysterectomy. You'll notice that there was no statistically significant difference in favor of TXA or placebo on that primary outcome. However, the authors did note that they realized upon randomization, the decision to make a hysterectomy was often made at that initial point, and so these were often included in the study, thus diluting the results a little bit. So because of this, they actually changed some of the outcomes and evaluated death due to PPH at any time, as well as death due to PPH when TXA was given in less than 3 hours. And you'll notice that TXA showed benefit in both of these, both statistically and numerically significant differences. Not only that, the numerically significant difference was favorable to TXA when it was given within 3 hours more so than at any time. This is the first instance showing that the temporal use of TXA has a lot of benefit as well. When it's given earlier, we see stronger outcomes. So in general with this study, the primary outcome was change mid-study, which must be taken into account when we're evaluating the validity of it. Not only that, one of the exclusion criteria I thought was interesting was that clinician unsure of potential benefit could exclude you from the trial, which I thought was interesting that a clinician would have the power to basically decide who comes into the trial or not, thus providing potential bias. Third, PPH diagnosis was made clinically. They did educate their providers to state that if they thought that there was more than 500 cccs of blood loss for the PPH, then that was included them into this PPH diagnosis. However, there was no actual definitive measurement made. And then fourth, delayed administration showed inconsistent benefit. So patients that got TXA beyond 3 hours typically showed inconsistent benefit as compared to those that got it within 3 hours. But in general, for all comers, it was shown to be statistically significantly beneficial. So what about the second trial, TRAP trial, which looked at it for prophylaxis in PPH? Once again, it was a large study in 15 French hospitals with a sample size just over 4,000 patients. And you got randomized to the same dosing regimen versus placebo in addition to oxytocin. Now, this study recognized some of the concerns with the WOMAN trial and actually did two different things. They definitively diagnosed PPH using a collector bag and stating that more than 500 cc's said you had the definitive diagnosis, which represents that first outcome. They also asked the providers right when they left the room or that interaction with the patient, did they believe that the patient had PPH? So a provider assessed clinically significant bleeding. And then lastly, they looked at the additional use of uterotonics like oxytocin. So you'll notice PPH incidence when actually measured at greater than 500 cc's per the collector bag, there was no statistically significant difference in favor of TXA, although it was numerically different and better. That being said, the provider assessed clinically significant hemorrhage did favor TXA statistically significantly. And not only that, also reduced use of additional uterotonics. So once again, we have this PPH diagnosis and now we're not seeing a difference. But then the question must be asked is, what is the value of provider-assessed clinically significant bleeding? And does that matter with our patients and should it impact how we use TXA? Based on this data, though, the authors did not recommend the use of TXA for prophylaxis in PPH, but they do recommend its use in treatment based on the women trial results. So at this time, we will only recommend it for treatment, with further research looking into potentially its use in prophylaxis as well. So what about trauma? So trauma, I would argue, is what got TXA to be so famous in the last 10 years. And that was primarily due to the CRASH II trial, which came out in 2010. The CRASH II trial was, once again, a huge study, 274 hospitals in 40 different countries, with a sample size just over 20,000 patients. Now, one thing to note is out of those 40 countries, the majority were in developing countries and not necessarily developed countries with mature healthcare systems such as our own here at Mayo Clinic or in the U.S. in general. An important inclusion I want to point out is within 8 hours of injury. So they randomized any patients within 8 hours of random injury, and then they stratified based on time as well in a subgroup analysis. The dosing regimen also varied. It was 1 gram over 10 minutes, then 1 gram infusion over 8 hours versus placebo. And this is the more standard regimen you'll see for TXA in hemorrhage-associated bleeding. In terms of the primary outcomes for the CRASH II trial, they looked at all-cause mortality, and they found a 1.5% difference in favor of tranexamic acid in the dark blue here. Not only that, they also looked at death due to hemorrhage, which only saw a 0.8% difference in favor of TXA. However, there still was that mortality benefit noted. But what I find more interesting about this trial was when they actually stratified based on time to administration. And you'll notice here that the patients that got it within 3 hours in both all-cause mortality as well as death by bleeding saw more significant benefit, or statistically significant benefit, I should state, instead of the beyond 3 hour group, which saw no benefit. So once again, similar to the women trial, we're seeing this concept of earlier administration might mean more impactful outcomes for our patients. And we'll revisit this topic more with future studies. Now, one thing to note with the CRASH II trial was the fact that a lot of the injuries were secondary to blunt trauma. So the MATTERS trial was conducted as a single center retrospective observational study in southern Afghanistan in one regional hospital there. And all these patients that were included in this study were secondary to penetrating trauma or injuries, so primarily gunshot wounds. An important thing with this study as well is that all patients had to require transfusion within 24 hours. And not only that, given its single center retrospective observational design, patients were not randomized to one group or the other. So they just took any patients that had received TXA within an hour of admission or injury versus standard care, which gives it that 1-to-2 ratio for sample size. Furthermore, you'll notice that more patients in the TXA group actually received massive transfusion as compared to the standard of care. Now, you might be thinking that doesn't really make sense based on the mechanism of action. You'd think they'd have less bleeding if they received TXA. And this was noted based on the fact that the people in the TXA group were actually more sick at baseline, the authors noted. And this was found through statistically significant differences at baseline between mean injury severity scores. They had lower GCS scores, and they had higher times in the OR as well. And once again, this is a southern Afghanistan regional hospital as well, so how much does it relate to a place that has more resources for healthcare as well should be taken into consideration. Their primary outcome they evaluated was overall mortality. And you'll notice no statistically significant difference at 24 hours between TXA and placebo. However, at 48 hours and 30 days, there was a significant difference in favoring of TXA, with a number needed to treat of only 14 and 15, respectively. But what's more impressive is when they looked at massive transfusion mortality. You'll notice at 48 hours and 30 days, the TXA arm had about half the mortality of the placebo arm, with a number needed to treat of only 8 for both of those patients. So while TXA in these penetrating trauma injuries did not benefit in terms of mortality at 24 hours, we were seeing long-term benefits in outcomes of our patients at both 48 hours and 30 days. The authors go on to conclude that TXA was independently associated with survival in massive transfusion patients with an odds ratio of 7.23. So once again, we have now established that TXA is beneficial in trauma-associated hemorrhage in both blunt injuries as well as penetrating traumas. But the question must be asked, you know, how relatable is this back to our patient population that we're seeing? And hopefully with future studies, and there's new studies coming out right now, this will be further evaluated. Now, one thing that those trials did do is they excluded patients that had intracranial bleeding. So it was all extracranial bleeding that they recruited into their trials. So two major trials have since come out trying to evaluate what happens if we put this in patients with TBI secondary to ICHs. And the two major trials are the TITCH2 and the CRASH3 trial that just recently came out as well. Now, the TITCH2 trial was once again a large trial in 124 hospitals in 12 countries, with just over 2,000 patients enrolled. Once again, we see within 8 hours of stroke symptom onset or last seen well. It's important exclusion criteria to point out to you is modified Rankin score greater than 4 at baseline. Modified Rankin scale score goes from 0 to 6, with 0 being no functional decline, whereas 6 is equivalent to death. So when you get to about 4 to 5, we see severe disability in patients. So it's a measure of functional outcomes. Not only that, they excluded patients with life expectancy less than 3 months as judged by clinician, as well as a GCS score less than 5. And GCS goes from 3 to 15, with the lower being associated with poorer outcomes. One other thing to note as well is that they also excluded patients with any anticoagulation, thrombolysis, trauma, or structural abnormality. So just thinking about how does this relate back to our patients. Once again, they used the same dosing regimen as well compared to our CRASH-2 and MATTERS trial. Their primary outcome looked at modified Rankin scale score outcome at day 90. So assessing functional outcomes in patients after 3 months from injury. And you'll notice with tranexamic acid being in the dark blue versus placebo in the light blue, that there's virtually no difference between the two arms. So they went on to assess and state that there's no functional outcome changes between tranexamic acid versus placebo, but what about mortality? Well, at day 7, they did see a statistically significant difference favoring the TXA group. However, that difference was lost once again at day 90. So the question must be asked, we're keeping our patients alive for the first week statistically significantly with the TXA use, but does it really matter if at day 90 there's no functional outcome changes as well as there's no mortality outcome differences between the two arms? They also went on to look at both hematoma expansion and mean hematoma volume expansion from baseline. And both of these outcomes did favor the TXA arm. Of note, hematoma expansion at day 2 was 4% less in the TXA group with a number needed to treat of only 25, as compared to mean hematoma volume expansion, it was about 1.2 cc's less in the TXA arm at 24 hours. However, once again, it did not translate to a 90-day improvement in patients' functional outcome or mortality, only at 7 days. So it might keep our patients alive longer in the short term, but that benefit might not be seen in the long term. So shortly after this trial came out, they wanted to go out and CRASH-3 came out to discuss a little bit more about intracranial bleeding on a large scale. And they wanted to fix a couple of the things that they saw was wrong with this trial, particularly the fact of the limitation that most patients were enrolled greater than 3 hours after ICH. So a major limitation with this was that only 36% of patients were enrolled within the first 3 hours, as well as there's broad inclusion and specific exclusion, so it seemed like they were fishing for a specific type of patient. But to recap, we only saw reduced death within 7 days, but no difference in death in 90 days or MRS. Of note, the rate of hematoma expansion and ME volume was decreased, as I mentioned. So CRASH-3 wanted to fix some of the things that TITCH2 might not have done very well. Once again, the CRASH-3 was just over 12,000 patients in 175 hospitals in 29 countries, sharing similar concerns to the CRASH-2 trial, with most of the countries being in developing countries and not developed countries. Now, of note, their primary inclusion criteria was an adult with a TBI within 3 hours of injury. This was changed partway through the study when they decided that there was new data coming out saying that beyond 3 hours might not be beneficial for patients. The authors changed it completely on their own without consulting their data and safety monitoring board or their statistical group. They just felt that the data was strong enough that they could make the change. So that should be taken as a potential limitation of the trial as well. They also included patients with a GCS less than or equal to 12 and any intracranial bleeding on CT, but they excluded anyone with extracranial bleeding noted. We see the same intervention arms as well as the last trial. Their primary outcome looked at head injury-related death within 28 days. And you'll note no statistical significant difference in all patients, nor patients excluding a GCS of 3 with bilateral unreactive pupils. Now, this was a pre-specified sensitivity analysis because bilateral unreactive pupils, or GCS of 3, is a very poor prognostic factor for patients with ICHs. Once again, looking at the relative risk of both of these arms and head injury-related death, you can see that there is no statistically significant difference, unfortunately. But what I find most interesting from this study was this graph that I've reproduced here. To note on this graph, the y-axis is the risk ratio, where the x-axis is time to treatment. And they've stratified this into two different arms, with the first arm being mild to moderate GCS score, which is a GCS of 9 to 15, compared to severe GCS score, which is a GCS of less than 9. Now, you'll note the slope of the lines on this graph. With a mild to moderate, it's showing a stronger relative risk in favor of tranexamic acid that slowly loses its ability as we get closer to 3 hours. And once it hits 180 minutes, that line on the top bar crosses 1, so it loses statistical significance. As compared to the severe GCS score, which essentially has a slope of 0, meaning that at no time was it really that beneficial to use TXA. So what the authors concluded based off of this is that potentially in mild to moderate ICHs, there might be benefit of using TXA, especially if we use it early. And the earlier you're seeing more benefit compared to severe GCS or those with bilateral unreactive pupils not getting that benefit. So the question must be asked, does TXA have a benefit in mild to moderate GCS or reactive pupils within 3 hours? It's an interesting thought. However, it does still feel somewhat like fishing from the study, since they're trying to find some reason or some sort of outcome where we could use TXA. Interestingly enough, once again, we see a forest plot here looking at head injury-related death within 24 hours, and you'll note mild to moderate did have a statistically significant benefit, as well as reactive pupils. However, severe and any non-reactive pupils did not have a statistically significant benefit. In addition to that, head injury-related death, you can see the relative risks here. It was favoring the TXA group in both head injury-related death and excluding GCS in bilateral unreactive pupils, but only at 24 hours. Now, this is in contrast to that first graph I had showed, which showed it at 28 days. So we can conclude that all patients saw a reduction in head injury-related death at 24 hours, but the benefit was not sustained at 28 days, which is sounding very similar to the previous data I had reported, right? We're seeing early benefit in our patients, but it's not sustained in the long term, unfortunately. Not only that, it reduced head injury-related death in mild to moderate head injury or reactive pupils. So the question might be asked, is this a potential agent for those patients, and how do we assess that? Interestingly enough, the CRASH-3 trial went on to do some subsequent analyses as well. And one of them they did was stratifying by income of country as based by the definition of the World Food Bank. So they wanted to evaluate high-income countries versus low- and middle-income countries and what the benefit difference might be. And as you can see here, they actually saw that TXA had a lower relative risk in a high-income country as compared to low- and middle-income countries, which is interesting. And then not only that, comparing the two relative risks, there was no statistically significant difference. So this is the first study looking at TXA's use stratified by income to try to address that concern of, is the actual positive benefits diluted based on the fact that we're looking at a lot of developing countries versus developed. Not only that, they looked at mean disability rating scale score and once again found no difference between the two arms, whether it was administered within 3 hours versus beyond 3 hours once again. So at this time, ICH gets a red question mark because we're not really sure where its place lies based on these two trials. Some may argue that there is that benefit in mild to moderate GCS or with reactive pupils, but I believe that there needs to be more data before we start widespread recommending its use in this patient population, especially when contrasting it to the TITCH2 trial, which was shooting for more of a mid to moderate GCS score based on their exclusion criteria, and they did not see the same benefit. So next, I want to switch gears and talk a little bit about more of the alternative uses of tranexamic acid, being epistaxis and hemoptysis. Epistaxis, most people, when they think of its use in nosebleeds, they refer to this as a head study. Notably, it was a single-center randomized parallel group clinical study conducted in Iran. To be included, you had to be on currently taking an antiplatelet, and you had to have persistent bleeding despite 20 minutes of compression with finger and thumb. Exclusion criteria, any sort of anticoagulant use, as well as coagulopathic disorders. They only had a sample size of about 124 patients, and patients were randomized to get topical tranexamic acid in a soaked cotton pledget, which is essentially like a cotton ball that you soak and it'll expand, versus anterior packing with epinephrine and lidocaine, which is considered to be the standard of care. Now, their primary outcome was looking at cessation of bleeding at 10 minutes, and you'll notice that the TXA in the dark blue bar here had 73% of patients have stopped bleeding within 10 minutes compared to only 29% in the placebo group, producing a number needed to treat of only 3. And not only that, looking at epistaxis recurrence, while there was not a statistically significant difference at 24 hours, the difference was seen at 1 week, with about 1/4 of patients in the TXA arm seeing benefit. Interestingly enough, and this is the most impressive statistic I felt like from this study, was the fact of being discharged from the ED in under 2 hours. 97% of people in the TXA arm were able to get in and out of the ED very quickly using TXA, compared to only 13% in the anterior packing. This equated to the most important outcome, patient satisfaction. Patient satisfaction associated with topical TXA was scored at 9 out of 10, as compared to anterior PEC being only 4 out of 10. And this was all patient reported via survey. So the ZAHED study shows us that TXA stops bleeding earlier, reduces time spent in the ED, improves patient satisfaction, and may reduce bleeding occurrence. So for now, I would consider it to be a good option in epistaxis. Now, that being said, there's only a few case reports, case studies out there looking at its use, and I think that it should be used in a certain type of patient. Not any patient that gets a nosebleed on your floor comes into the ED should be started on topical TXA right away as a first-line therapy. It's usually in those refractory cases or if they're on something chronic at baseline. And then lastly, I wanted to briefly discuss hemoptysis. Now, there's only one prospective randomized clinical trial from what I could find for the use of inhaled TXA for hemoptysis. That was a study published in Chest in 2018 by Wand and colleagues. So a single-center, double-blind, randomized controlled trial. Of note, some of the exclusion criteria included massive hemoptysis, which was defined as greater than 200 cc's of blood in the last 24 hours, as well as respiratory or hemodynamic compromise and coagulopathy. Now, of note, their sample size was extremely small at only 47 patients. They did state that they met power, though, based on the expected difference between the two trial arms. Patients were randomized to nebulized TXA 3 times a day at 500 milligrams, so it is 5 cc's, again, of the normal IV solution, versus placebo, which was just normal saline, and they used it up to 5 days. Now, with the WAN study, the initial primary outcome they had was resolution of hemoptysis within 5 days. And you'll note that TXA, 96% of patients actually had that resolution, as compared to only 50% in the normal saline group. Furthermore, looking at one-year follow-up, you can see here that mortality was not different. However, there was a significant difference between placebo and TXA for recurrent hemoptysis at one-year follow-up. That being said, there's some questionable concerns related to a one-year follow-up outcome, especially because they didn't control for any other confounders that could be contributing to this as well. In general, though, the WAN study, I feel like, has a lot of questionable things that occurred. First, it had a tiny sample size. Second, it looked at only non-massive hemoptysis, which they cited. They didn't want to use massive hemoptysis patients because they might require more urgent and immediate therapy. And third, it had some really sketchy arithmetic from what I could tell. So if you actually look at the study itself, they report specific percentages that are actually incorrect if you do it with the raw data yourself, which is pretty interesting considering it was published in Chest as well. And then lastly, GI bleed. There's only one Cochrane review out there right now that most people cite. However, it's relatively poor based on poor level of data, so I didn't want to discuss it very much for the purposes of this presentation. However, interestingly enough, there's some great data that's supposed to be coming out soon surrounding GI bleed. So in summary, TXA has shown benefit in perioperative bleeding, in the treatment of PPH, but not for prophylaxis, in trauma for patients, questionable in ICH at the current time, benefit in epistaxis. I give it a red question mark for hemoptysis just based on some of my own concerns with the WAN study until further data is out there. And furthermore, to expand on that, the authors even go out as far as to say is don't do interventions based on this study and the discussion based on all of those concerning factors. And then GI bleed, more to come, which we'll talk about with coming down the pipeline studies. So this leads me to my second question here. Based on the presented studies, which of the following regarding TXA is true? It decreases mortality in hemoptysis patients, reduces the incidence of PPH when used for prevention, decreases mortality in trauma patients, and it does not affect hematoma expansion rates in ICH. So I would agree with the majority of the audience here that it does decrease mortality in trauma patients, as shown by the CRASH II trial and MATTERS trial. It does not decrease mortality in hemoptysis patients, as shown at one-year follow-up by the WAN study. It reduces the incidence of PPH when used for prevention. That was not shown to be in definitive PPH as measured by collector bag, but it did show a statistically significant difference in provider-assessed clinically significant bleeding in the TRAP study. And then lastly, it does affect hematoma expansion rates, as noted by the TITCH2 study. So next, I wanted to talk about a little bit about the pearls related to TXA, specifically the adverse effects. Because if you look it up in any drug info resource or handbook, it'll state that it might be prothrombotic, as well as it can cause potentially seizures. So I wanted to highlight what each of the studies found. And most of the prothrombotic concern comes from the MATTERS trial initially. And of note, the MATTERS trial did find a 9 times increased risk of PE, as well as a 12 times increased risk of DVT, stating that it is prothrombotic. However, they also, if you remember, did note that the patients in the TXA arm were at baseline sicker. Not only that, they recognize that with that large mortality difference, there might be a somewhat of a survivorship bias. In patients that did survive, they had a higher risk of potentially getting this thrombosis later on. Once again, though, looking at all the other studies that reported thrombosis risk, there is no difference that's repeated once again. So I feel that it would be okay to state that it's not prothrombotic at this time, but it should always be questioned or on your radar. Is TXA associated with seizures? So at the very beginning of the presentation, I talked about the Atticus study, which found a seizure risk. Now, of note, the Atticus study initially started dosing patients at 100 milligrams per kilogram, which they found was a large dose, and it was causing a lot of seizures. So they subsequently halved the dose to 50 milligrams per kilogram, and the seizures subsided somewhat. As compared to the other studies that use standard dosing regimens, there is no seizure risk noted. So at an appropriate dose and used appropriately, based off of these studies for the other indications, I would be comfortable stating that there is not seizure risk associated with TXA. And then lastly, I wanted to highlight some of the different dosing regimens of TXA. Once again, the standard dosing regimen for most patients is 1 gram over 10 minutes followed by a gram over 8 hours. This is in contrast to topical and inhaled formulations. Now, topical, you usually will do 500 milligrams or 5 cc's. They just use usually the IV solution itself to get that 5 cc's. And for Zahed, they use a soaked cotton pledget, or another study by Atkin, which I didn't present on, used an atomized spray and found similar benefits to the Zahed study. So there's multiple different ways you can give it topically for epistaxis. The Wan study used 5 cc's of nebulized solution 3 times a day, and you just put it into the nebulizer chamber, and then they can have the patient inhale it that way. So here at Mayo, I actually went around and took some different pictures of things we might have in case you were ever to be asked, how do I give TXA in one of these alternate forms? So on the bottom left is a cotton pledget that we actually carry. Now, cotton pledgets, you just soak and they will expand. And so you just soak it in that TXA 5 cc's and put it in the patient's nose, and it should expand and stop bleeding, hopefully. Here at Mayo, we are fortunate that we have our own compression devices. So you don't have to use your finger and thumb. Patients can actually use a compression device to stop bleeding as well. An atomizer, so you'll just screw that tip onto the end of a syringe and spray into the nose after the patient blows their nose first. And then lastly, a nebulizer. You just put 5 cc's into the chamber and put it on the patient's mouth for them to deeply inhale to deliver it locally to the lungs. And this leads me to my last question of the presentation here. Which of the following regarding TXA is true? TXA has been shown to consistently increase VTE risk. A barrier to use of TXA is cost. TXA currently has a defined role in gastrointestinal bleeding. TXA reduces time spent in the ED due to epistaxis. So I agree with the majority of responses. TXA does reduce time spent in the ED due to epistaxis, as reported by the Zahed study. A is incorrect because TSA has not been shown to consistently increase VTE risk. Only the MATTERS trial identified that, but no other trials reproduced that VTE risk. TXA is actually very cheap and a very cost-effective agent. If you go on Lexicomp, it states its cost is about $2 to $8 per ml. So a standard dose would be a gram, which is 10 cc's. So anywhere from $20 to $80. To the patient, it might be more like $100 to $200 cost per intervention. But if you look at elsewhere in the world, it's around $2 or so. TXA currently has a defined role in GI bleed. It does not at the current time. However, I'm excited to announce that there is a study looking at it coming out soon. So I was curious, we've seen so much robust literature in the past 10 years. What's coming down the pipeline in terms of TXA's use? So I went on clinicaltrials.gov and searched it, and 430 studies came back. And then when I filtered for active and recruiting ongoing right now, there was still over 130 studies currently being done. So I perused through them and pulled out some that I thought would be interesting and that I'm going to try to keep an eye on that will be coming out here. The first one being the HALTED trial, the long-awaited TXA in gastrointestinal bleeding. It's expected to be complete in October of 2020. Three other trials that are currently recruiting include the TERRA trial, which is TXA in ruptured AAA, TRANSACT trial, which is TXA in spontaneous acute cerebral hemorrhage, and then TXA for hemorrhage prevention and cesarean delivery. I think all three of these will be really interesting, as well as I'm excited to see how much literature is going to be coming out and research surrounding TXA in the future years. So in summary, there's unclear impact in developed countries. I feel that this is one of the biggest reservations with widespread use of TXA, just because we know it's such a cost-effective, easy intervention in developing countries. But in developed countries or institutions like Mayo Clinic, do we still see such a benefit? Second, TXA has not been shown to consistently in the studies to be either prothrombotic or seizure-provoking. I think these are both relatively large myths surrounding TXA's use, but you can definitely report on the literature and what it showed up to this point if a team is concerned about it. And then lastly, TXA has shown potential benefits in multiple indications, with many more indications being further evaluated. As I mentioned, there's about 430 studies currently looking at TXA's use, and more research is coming out surrounding its use in these alternative indications as well. So I'm excited to see what the roadmap looks like for TXA, considering it's been around for over 60 years now.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.